You're listening to Giles Brown on TRE Talk Radio Europe, your voice in Spain. The plot to save South Africa. The week Mandela averted civil war and forged a new nation. 9 days that set the course of a nation. Johannesburg, 1993. Mandela had been free for 3 years and was in slow-moving power talks with President F.W. de Klerk. What happened next is the subject of a book by acclaimed South African journalist Justice Malala. Delighted to be joining me live on the line. Justice himself. Justin, good afternoon from us. Good morning to you.
Good afternoon to you. It's lovely to be here. Thanks for asking me.
The pleasure's all mine. It seems, 30 years ago. Unbelievable the way that time goes.
It is. I mean, I was 22 years old. It was my first day at work when this happened. And I look back now and it's, wow, we went through that. We got through it. It's extraordinary.
And if you think about it, I mean, when I remember watching when Mandela walked free in 1990, those incredible pictures of a nation rejoicing, and then Mandela obviously in talks with the previous regime. Now we look back and we realize that this was the birth of the Rainbow Nation. But at the time, we had no idea what would happen next, whether South Africa would become a functioning democracy, whether there would be anger, there would be violence. It was a really difficult and dangerous time.
It was. I remember that time as being one where you got up in the morning, you turned on your radio, and the news bulletins would be all about how many people had died the previous night in political violence. The violence had spread from KwaZulu-Natal, which is in the southeast, had spread to the economic hub of Johannesburg. You know, if you take 1993, and say the moment that you describe 3 years before had been so full of hope, and all of us thought, you know, it's a straight line, it's the highway to freedom. But actually, it had turned out very differently. It was ups and downs, despair, hope. You never knew what the next day would bring. And so the weekend that I begin this book with is that turning point when after 3 years of these negotiations not going anywhere, you have a right-wing racist activist of sorts with an MP plotting to kill Nelson Mandela's heir apparent, the man who was more popular than any other political leader in the country, besides Mandela.
Because at the time, of course, and you have to, I think, maybe applaud, would it be right to say, de Klerk? Because it would have been really easy for him to say, as perhaps Botha had done before, we've been running this country for 100 years. You know, the black community do not know how to look after themselves. South Africa will go down the path of Zimbabwe. There will be bloodshed on the streets. These people cannot... these people are terrorists. They cannot run the country. And de Klerk opened up dialogue.
Yes. So de Klerk had opened up dialogue in 1989, released Mandela in 1990. The two men's relationship was quite interesting. Mandela walked out of prison in 1990 in that moment you describe and said, F.W. de Klerk is a man of integrity. De Klerk had said, Mandela is a man I can do business with. So it had started off well. But by year three, Mandela said, De Klerk, you're the president. Why aren't you stopping the violence? De Klerk was saying, Mandela, you're the president and leader of the ANC. Why aren't you telling your supporters not to participate in the violence? So the relationship had broken down. But to the point you're making, on the day when Chris Hani is murdered, there are two things that happen. Mandela gets on the phone, speaks to his advisors. De Klerk gets on the phone and speaks to his advisors. And both men, within 2 hours of the murder, call each other. They have a conversation for 30 minutes in which that dynamic that you refer to begins to come through. De Klerk says to Mandela, look, I'm unable to speak to these angry people whose hero has been assassinated, whose hero, the images were flying all over the country and the world of this man shot four times and dead in his own blood, in his own driveway. And De Klerk says, you have to be the leader today. You have to lead. And Mandela says yes. And they agree that Mandela will go on television that evening and give a speech calling for peace. Mandela was far out in his rural home. De Klerk had also gone far out into the semi-desert in South Africa to his grandmother's farm. And so these two men in two very different places, far from the hub of Johannesburg, where the action was taking place, decide that together we have to work together to save the process that was unfolding and the country from civil war and racial civil war.
I mean, you describe Chris Haney as the heir apparent. For those who maybe, you know, have forgotten who he was, just describe a little bit about his, you know, why he was Mandela's, who was supposed to be the next thing.
Chris Haney had been born to a very, very poor family, absolutely indigent. He went to a local Catholic school. He got fascinated by the church. He loved singing. He loved reading the Bible. He got interested in Latin, pulled himself up by his bootstraps, got into university, became conscientized about apartheid, joined the ANC, became one of its first guerrilla fighters. Then he had a long career in the ANC, sort of fighting against apartheid. When De Klerk released Mandela in 1990, FW was one of the first people to come back. Now, he also happened to be a leader in the Communist Party of South Africa. And at that time, communism was seen as, ooh, this is terrible. These are the guys who are going to destroy the country and so forth. And he was extremely charming. At his first meeting with De Klerk and his cabinet, for example, he went up to one guy who had studied classics at Oxford and Cambridge. And he said to him, hey, man, I read your PhD dissertation. I thought you were wrong about Sophocles and blah, blah, blah. This guy thinks, oh, my word, I thought this was a terrorist coming out of the bush with his AK-47. And so they have a long 30-minute discussion about Sophocles and Greek myth and so forth. He was that sort of guy, very charming. When he first met Archbishop Desmond Tutu, he went up to him and said, hey, it's been so long since I sang that hymn. And he reminds Tutu of this hymn composed 120 years ago. He says, can we sing it before we begin our meeting? Now, Tutu had been like, these communists are not great for me, you know? And Tutu is just totally flawed. So he was very charming, very charismatic. He was loved by young people. Surveys had been done showing that he was the most popular after Mandela. In the period up to his assassination, he'd been saying, we need to make sure that young people get into peace corps, we give them a future and they don't feel alienated by this democratization process,
because there had been problems with the young ANC getting more and more militant. The things like the death of Stompie McKenzie, for example, had been a big situation for that, and obviously Winnie as well had been something of a difficult situation, I think we can call it, for Mandela himself.
Absolutely. You know, Mandela had split from Winnie Mandela, and he was facing attacks that he was not militant enough. There was a rising militancy in parts of the ANC, even as negotiations were taking place. But Chris Haney was interesting in that as the negotiations progressed, he began to say, let's give these young people a stake in this process. Let's give them a way to see that they have a future. So he started, when he on the Friday before, on the Thursday before he was murdered, on his desk, there was a notebook, and he'd been writing youth, his notes were young people, turning them into peace committees so that they don't take part in violence and so forth. So you're absolutely right. Young people, you know, at the time, sociologists had termed a phrase for young people like me, they're called the lost generation. And the lost generation came from the fact that schooling had been disrupted in the 1980s. Many young people didn't go to school. Violence had taken hold. And so these young people were the ones taking part in this violence, exacerbating it in many instances. And so it was a real problem. So when Chris Hani was murdered, it is these young people who were angriest and wanted to lash out at the world.
On the other side, of course, we have the white supremacist. What do we know of him? Was it acting alone? Because we talk about, you know, they both Mandela and de Klerk were away from Johannesburg. South Africa is a huge country. And although the urban centres, there may be talk of reconciliation, on those rural areas of South Africa, there was very much a feeling of, well, this is the way we have always done it. This is the way, you know, forget Joburg, forget Cape Town. This is the way that we do things here.
Yeah. You know, at that time, over the 3 years of negotiations, the right wing had been receiving support from international right-wing groupings. They had become more and more emboldened and scared about the future, and so had been organizing. The National Intelligence Agency in South Africa, and I write about a bit about this in the book, said there were militias organized, armed, and they were being addressed by, for example, a leader of a former general in the army, Constant Viljoen, had spoken to people, addressed people. Other leaders had done the same. And then there was a man called Eugene Terreblanche, who was a fiery orator who, you know, spoke violence, who said after Chris Hani's murder that I would have killed him myself if I'd had the chance. So you had this rising right-wing militancy that said we've got to stop this process of democratization, and you had essentially on the one hand black anger, and then you had all these fears and anger and violence from the white right-wing fanatics. And so the assassin had been influenced since the mid-1980s by these forces. He was a Polish immigrant who had got in with a man called Clive W. Lewis, who was a conservative MP in South Africa. And he'd been essentially, in this one instance by Clive W. Lewis, influenced highly to take part in this plot, and they had put it in motion. Now there are many indications that it may be a wider plot. In my book, I speculate about it. I touch on some of the aspects, but to be frank, there is no evidence that has been put forward yet of a wider plot. It's one of those. It's like JFK. It's like Martin Luther King. Will continue to speculate for a long time.
Plot or not, it put tremendous pressure and strain on the relationship between the communities and, more importantly, the leaders. And although we talked about these two men, you know, when in 1990, and it all seemed very successful and it was going to end very well, but their true leadership skills came out at this point and over the 9 days that you describe.
Yes, absolutely. So I mean, I think the first point of leadership is that conversation that we've spoken about when Nelson Mandela and F.W. de Klerk speak for 30 minutes. Now, you know, you and I would say leadership is together we go forward, we do something. But I think you know, you touched on de Klerk earlier in the conversation. And I think the first act of leadership is actually realizing that perhaps I can't do anything. You can do it. And de Klerk did it that Saturday when he said to Mandela, I cannot. In fact, he writes in his memoir that this was Mandela's moment. If I spoke to these very pained young people, I would exacerbate, I would make things worse. And he said, I've got to step back. Mandela's name, you know, up to 1990, you couldn't mention Mandela's name on television or radio, or else you'd get a 5-year sentence. And yet on that day, Mandela went and spoke to the nation as if he was the president of the country, not being interviewed, but speaking directly into camera. So I think that's the first part of the leadership, that Mandela stepped up, that de Klerk knew to step back. There are other elements. I think, you know, that speech that evening, Mandela's was a terrible speech. He couldn't read it properly. His eyes were dry, had been damaged on Robben Island. And Mandela realized that, no, that speech was a dud. And 3 days later, he gave the speech of his life. I'd like your listeners to read the book, so I'm not going to give it away. But it's one of the key moments when he gives this speech that turns things around somewhat, not completely, but somewhat.
How did you go about writing this? Did you take, I mean, you were in South Africa as a younger man. Like I'm the same age as you, so we were both younger men, we will say. But is it from your own memories? Is it from, because you were obviously working in media and newspapers at that point. Is it reading those memoirs? Is it looking at contemporary reports and speaking to people who were involved at the time?
Yeah. So the first thing I'll say, and this surprised me, it's memory and the place of memory in historical research. It's that my word, we forget. If you read de Klerk's book, he says Mandela went on television on that evening of the 10th, and he said Mandela was fantastic. He gave the speech of his life. Mandela himself in his memoir says, oh, that evening I went on television and it was all good and so forth. Now, I'll tell you, that day I went to Chris Hani's home. After that, I was assigned to go to Soweto to see what was happening. I couldn't get into Soweto. It was just rioting all over the place. Now, I also remembered at the beginning of doing my research that, oh yeah, Nelson Mandela gave a speech and it was amazing. None of that happened. Mandela gave the speech that night. It was a terrible speech. It was a dud. Okay? So I interviewed, Mandela had already passed away when I started working on the book. I'll go and interview de Klerk and he tells me exactly the same thing. Oh, Mandela gave a speech and there was peace on earth. It wasn't like that. So part of writing this book was that I had to go and actually read day to day all the newspapers. I went into the archives. I tried to get as much written material as I could. And I'll tell you this, the one thing many of us don't do, I don't know if you do it, but I don't keep a diary, and many of us don't. There was one person, there was a young reporter at the time who had been asked by Mandela's publisher to help him write his memoirs. His name was Richard Stengel, and he actually wrote a book about Mandela's leadership, totally not connected. I mean, there's a chapter on Chris Hani, but he had kept a diary and he said to me, yeah, you can have a look at my diary. And he gave me the 7 days that he'd managed to write something. And that began to put things in perspective. And I began to piece together these 9 days. And actually, you know, all of us should keep a diary. That's one thing I say to anyone, because memory is 30 years down the line or 26, 27 years down the line. We don't remember, or things are just not reliable anymore. So that's part of what I did. And then I was very lucky. I got some minutes of how the apartheid system worked, of how de Klerk and his cabinet got to make the big concession of the week, and that was to agree that there would be they would agree to an election date after Chris Hani's murder. So that those were sort of the big breaks, and I got other bits and pieces. I spoke to a lot of the people who were there, and but as I say, memory is terrible.
Well, that's the thing, because we, I mean, a lot of us can forget about that, especially who weren't in South Africa. Just think it was, they remember 1990, they remember Mandela coming out, and then they remember that iconic 1994 Rainbow Nation Rugby World Cup with, you know, Mandela in the South African shirt giving Francois Pienaar the World Cup. And it seemed like a beautiful, smooth translation. But obviously, your book, The Plot to Save South Africa, shows how close we came to total anarchy in South Africa.
Absolutely. I think it's those moments when we don't remember that make history so interesting. And I found there were so many things in that week when I was there, and yet I was surprised by how perilous it was, how close, as you say, to absolute anarchy we came. The organizing and machinations that were going in the ANC, with people saying to Mandela, no, we've got to go to war. There was a real element in the ANC that said, this is over, this talking is over. In de Klerk's, on de Klerk's side, the right wing was absolutely adamant. I mean, 9 days after Chris Hani's murder, as he was being buried, the streets to the funeral were lined with right wingers armed to the teeth, threatening fire and brimstone. It looked like it was going to, anything could have set it off. The ANC marshals and mourners, you know, it's a small cemetery. It can take, built to take maybe 200, 300 people. 20,000 people turn up for that funeral. And you know, there's guns being set off in the cemetery, and it's chaos and mayhem. But they, you know, people managed to keep it together. Cooperation between cops and ANC marshals kept it together, and we got through those 9 days and got to 1994, as you say, which was a great and amazing moment. But it wasn't smooth sailing to that moment.
I urge listeners to go out and purchase this book. You'll be able to buy the book, by the way, whether by a virtual download. This book is called The Plot to Save South Africa, The Week Mandela Averted Civil War and Forged a New Nation. It's by Justice Malala, who we're speaking to today. Justice, if people want to find more information about you, I know you have a website because I checked it out earlier. Where can they find you online?
They can find me online. Good old Google is good for that sort of thing, but you can find me on justicemalala.com. You can follow me on Twitter at Justice Malala. I've also got an Instagram account now. Yay! it's Justice Malala SA.
Wonderful. The book is called The Plot to Save South Africa, The Week Mandela Averted Civil War and Forged a New Nation. It's by Justice Malala, who we've been speaking to today. Justice, it's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been great. Thank you.